Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It is a strange fact that immigrants from Latin America suffer fewer diseases of Western culture than their citizen relatives. The longer they remain in the U.S., the more prone they are to diabetes, cancer, and other diseases. Even learning to speak English correlates with poorer health. That was part of the basis of a new book by Luz Calvo and Catriona Rueda Esquivel. Decolonize Your Diet is a reintroduction to traditional pre-colonial Mexican foods and methods of food preparation. Calvo is a professor of ethnic studies at Cal State East Bay, teaching a course entitled Decolonize Your Diet, Food Justice in Communities of Color. And Esquivel is an associate professor in race and resistance studies at San Francisco State University. Her earlier book was entitled With Her Machete in Her Hand. Part historical exploration and part recipes, their book Decolonize Your Diet offers a new way of thinking about the food that we eat and how we can be more intimately connected to what we put into our bodies. I'm very pleased to welcome to Uprising Catriona. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, how did Spanish colonialism change the traditional indigenous Mexican diet? You know, we've seen a lot of histories of the effects, the impacts of colonialism, but we rarely stop and think about what it did to food.
I think it's really changed in dramatic ways. One way to think about it is that the original indigenous diet, indigenous Mexican diet, was largely corn, beans, greens, squashes, pumpkins, flowers, seeds. It's a very diverse diet. But with the coming of the Spanish, what you see is, first of all, you see a huge emphasis on wheat replacing corn, so wheat flour. And then you also have the introduction of pork, of beef, and of dairy foods like cheese, and then of different methods of cooking. So for example, indigenous food was grilled or toasted, but the Spaniards brought in the method of frying, which hadn't existed before in this hemisphere.
And what were the impacts, not just to food, but farming, to sort of the sources of the food, the ingredients?
Well, you know, one aspect of colonization was that the land was divided up and given to Spaniards as landholders, with the indigenous people doing the labor of, you know, large plantations growing foods. So the foods that they were growing were, again, they were really pushed to grow wheat in particular, and native grains were sort of pushed out of the food economy, particularly foods like chia and amaranth, which had both religious significance and cultural significance, were regarded as useless or even dangerous because they're blasphemous to the Catholic tradition. So those kinds of foods were really pushed to the margins, and sometimes they were even outlawed. You weren't supposed to grow them at all. But people continued to grow them on the borders of, you know, the legally mandated crops, and continued to sort of nurture these weeds, what's now regarded as weeds, but were a really important part of the diet.
So does the sustainability of food production go hand in hand with how healthy food is to humans?
Well, I think that it does. Some of the things to think about are the ways in which today's crops, you know, are really sort of monocultures, right? There's again, sort of big plantation areas devoted to one crop and only one crop. And those are largely based on what's profitable and marketable and not what people in the area need to survive and to live. Vandana Shiva has this amazing piece in her work, Staying Alive, where she talks about the fact that children in India go blind from lack of vitamin A, but that the most plentiful source of vitamin A is a wild green called bathwa, and that is eradicated with Monsanto's herbicides. And so to recognize that at the same time, like, all this money is being poured into GMO research saying, oh, we need to be growing golden rice, which has vitamin A in it. Again, instead of seeing, like, what was already there that contributed that important aspect of the diet, and how is that being pushed out by commercial crops?
Right, and golden rice was a crop that was touted for years and has been touted for years as this miracle food that's going to eradicate hunger in poor African countries. And so far, after, you know, many millions and billions of dollars spent, nothing has really come out of it. Let's talk about the fact that the nutrition...
Right. At the same time, the knowledge is already being disregarded. Mm. The knowledge of the people who live there about what is healthy is disregarded in favor of, oh, our Western science has the answers.
Right. Let's talk about the nutrition industry today. It's a huge industry. People are constantly looking for quick fixes for diseases, for obesity. There's an obsession with so-called superfoods, which are often these newly rediscovered indigenous foods. What do you make of this?
Well, again, it has a lot to do with the idea of profit. There's what's not being done is the traditional knowledges are not being validated. It's not saying, oh, people have known how to eat for thousands of years. Instead, it's like we have once again discovered this aspect of this indigenous culture and we're going to, you know, turn it to profit. So there's a way in which it's driven by commercialism and driven by the market and not really about whole food health and whole, you know, whole healing, whole diet healing.
Right. And we are looking for these quick fixes, these, you know, if only we add this one thing to our diet or take this supplement, it'll fix things. If we take vast quantities of one food, concentrate them, put them in a powder form and swallow them, you know, the profit makers push that on the one hand. But often ignorant consumers are kind of falling for this. And I'm wondering,
right, because I mean, the idea is that people don't really, you know, they don't really know how to change and they don't really want to change. So if you give people, if you say, okay, the diet is really bad, but all you need is this vitamin pill to add to it, then it's like, oh, well, I can function that way. And it also has to do with like our idea about future and progress. I mean, I remember watching cartoons as a child and seeing the Jetsons eating a pill for their whole meal and thinking, oh yeah, that's what the future is. That's what progress is. Instead of that, the future and progress is whole foods that are, you know, local and regional and healthy.
Your partner, Luz Calvo, had breast cancer, which seemed to be the impetus for the two of you rethinking your foods. But simply eating good foods and healthy foods cannot cure cancer, right? I mean, some people who have cancer might think that if they just have a healthy diet, they can wish away their cancer.
Yeah, we're really not making that kind of, you know, claim or argument. Instead, what we're saying is that, you know, a lot of traditional Western medicine doesn't look at diet at all. They don't really see any significance to it. But what we're really looking at is that if breast cancer occurs, right, what is it about indigenous groups such as migrant Mexicans or Central American women, they have really, really low incidences of breast cancer. And, you know, genetically, like Mexican Americans and migrant Mexicans are, you know, genetically very similar. So it's not really about the genes. It's about something about the lifestyle of these two groups is different enough that one group develops cancer at a much higher rate than the other group. So we were really sort of saying, what is it about the diet of Mexican and Central American migrant women that may have protected them against cancer until this point? So we're not, you know, we're not saying like, oh, your cancer will go away if you eat what we tell you to eat. I don't think that anybody can make those kinds of claims. And I also think that anybody dealing with cancer is having to make a lot of decisions about lifestyle, about treatment, about medicine. And we don't really want to sort of push anybody in a particular direction. But we do think it's important for our communities to start saying, what is it about the diet that can be changed, that can be protecting us before we start developing these diseases?
Let's talk about what we see today as Mexican cuisine, even things that might be named traditional Mexican cuisine that might really just be a product of overlapping with Spanish colonial foods. I mean, for example, you point out in your book that tortillas in most restaurants today are served as wheat tortillas, but really traditionally they've always been made of corn, right? So there's just a really a sort of a different take on traditional foods, indigenous foods that can get mistaken for traditional foods.
Right. And even, I mean, I think like a lot of middle America, they may have the concept of like the taco, right? And Taco Tuesdays and incorporating tacos as an easy meal into the regular diet. But what they're a lot of times using instead of homemade fresh corn tortillas, instead they're using these like highly processed taco shells that are so far from real food and whole food that it's really, it's not contributing anything to health. Instead, it's taking away from health. I think a lot of Mexican restaurants are associated with flour tortilla dishes, fried dishes, dishes covered in cheese, and lots of heavy use of oils. And again, none of those things are traditionally Mexican indigenous foods or food preparations. So I think it is really important to get people to think about, what is it that makes a food, what is it that contributes the ancestry to a food, and what is it is part of the current spin on how food should be prepared.
So tell us a little bit about how you and your partner, Luz Calvo, rediscovered, if you will, some of these traditional dishes, went back and looked at how dishes that we now know or take for granted had a different preparation. And you also have new spins on old dishes, right?
Right. I mean, I think that anything, when writing a cookbook today, it's going to be influenced by a lot of the trends of food today. But I think that, for example, one way in which we both sort of learned Mexican food, traditional Mexican food, was that when you made a red chile sauce, a cooked red chile sauce, it had a base, it had a roux made of toasted flour and oil, and then that was the thickener to the chile sauce. And when we were doing our research, we were like, well, that can't be traditional. I mean, if wheat flour was introduced by the Spaniards, and people had they the Spaniards talk about when they arrived, all the different kinds of chiles and sauces and moles and different foods like that that were available, right? They were doing that without wheat flour. So we were like, well, how did they do it? And by researching things like the codices from the 17th century, by researching letters from the conquistadors back to Spain, we would find references to foods being thickened with pumpkin seeds, being thickened with the ground corn masa, and that those kinds of things were the traditional way of doing it, and they got replaced, perhaps in the 19th century or the 18th century by Spanish or French traditions in cooking, but that the original indigenous practices were these made from the corn or from the pumpkin seeds, and that was the way that the food was thickened and rich, made richer and base of a meal.
Let's talk about some of the ingredients in your pantry, if you will, that you go through in your book. You say you're not purist. You do incorporate ingredients from other cultures in the modern era where they are
Right.
found to be beneficial to taste and health. For example, pasteurized butter, for which I'm very grateful because butter seems to be one of those very, very beautiful food ingredients. What are some of the foods in your pantry that form the basis for your recipe? Some of them I'd never even heard of. And of course, I'm not Mexican, so it's very likely that the Mexican American community would find these very familiar. But maybe there's foods even people who haven't really dug into indigenous roots are unfamiliar with.
Yeah, I think that there are some that are very familiar and some that are a lot less. For example, some things like nopales, that's the cactus plant, or the American, they call it the prickly pear cactus. Right, that is used as a vegetable, and the spines are cut off and it's sliced and it can be grilled, it can be sautéed. When you cook it, it has a real sort of like a slippery juice to it, the way that okra does, but that has immense health properties. So some people in sort of rural areas of Mexico or the southern United States grew up with that as a vegetable that they ate. It was like a poor people's vegetable that was always available. But if you're living in the city now, it's harder to find, but in Mexican markets, you can find it already despined and sliced and chopped up, or you can plant it in your yard and grow it, and it's very easy to cultivate and very easy to grow. Some of the other ingredients that we use that are a little bit more hard to find, one, for example, is called temezquite, and it's actually the mineral salt from the lakes in the Texcoco area of Mexico, and it's used as a leavening in some foods, and it's used to, you know, sort of condition the dough. And so, you know, when we were writing about that, we say, you know, if you can get this, this is how you use it. If you can't get this, this is how you substitute baking powder, but just know it's not exactly the same.
And I'm wondering also, does the sort of search for indigenous ingredients also lead one towards exploring the, you know, exploring other paths that question other aspects of colonialism? Because that was, you know, your book is much more than a recipe book. In a way, it's a history book too.
Right. I mean, because we were really researching the heck out of everything we were doing. You know, we were saying, like, what is the history of this? Part of it was also just sort of learning what foods were indigenous to the Americas. I mean, there's some that we all know, but then there's others that become associated with other cultures. Like, you'll hear, you know, you'll be reading Barbara Kingsolver and she'll be talking about, like, the Tuscan squash. And we're like, those were indigenous squashes that then, you know, became grown in a particular way in Tuscany, but that's, you know, part of the American tradition, or things like corn that were used as polenta in Italy, but were not prepared in the same way as they had been in the Americas with the nixtamalization process, which makes more of the ingredients, more of the nutrients bioavailable. And so they were actually healthier when prepared in indigenous America than they were when they were prepared in Europe or the European colonies.
Now, obviously, we live in the modern world today. Are there contradictions to reviving traditional means of cooking with the demands of modern life? And there's some ingredients in your book that might only be available online. Some you can try to grow, but if we're ordering things online or going to the, you know, the expensive health food stores, is that kind of antithetical to the idea of traditional and indigenous foods?
It is kind of a contradiction, but I mean, one thing to think about is that in a lot of places there are native communities who have been conserving these foods, like the Tohono O'odham community in Arizona. They use the traditional tepary bean, and the Tohono O'odham Community Action Group sells the tepary bean. So we feel good about buying it from them, but we also try to then say, okay, well, what can we grow ourselves? What can we, you know, what can we find locally? Again, the health food store is the sort of like capitalist dynamic, right, where the health food stores are extremely expensive and they always want to repackage. You know, they repackage this as the Inca berry, and they say, like, this is the superfood and you need to be paying like $8 an ounce for this food. And that's, you know, that's really very messed up. And also I think that one thing to think about is about foods that are local are not necessarily foods that that travel well. One thing that we kind of have been really fascinated by was fermentation of beverages. And throughout Mexico, there's lots of prickly pear beverages. And each area kind of has their own, but the beverages, whether you could call them like a soft drink or a beer or a wine, they don't travel. So, you know, you can't bottle them and sell them away in the city. They're, you can only get them in the regional areas. And that's just a dynamics. And so that's why we try to then learn to make our own, to see, like, okay, what would it be like if we grow it? If we make it in Oakland, you know, it's not going to be the same as the one made in Chiapas, but, you know, what would it end up tasting like? So there is like this era of experimentation, and like, well, let's just see how it goes.
Right. And so is trying to grow one's own food, which of course can be challenging if you say live in an apartment or in an area where it's cold most of the year, but is trying to grow one's own food part of rediscovering indigenous means of cooking and foods?
For us, it really is. I think growing food has been a big part for us, but it's also about sort of saying, okay, well, if this is not available in my area, what is available? Like, our grandmothers used verdolagas and quelites in what they cooked. But if you're, you know, in a different part of the country, then are you going to use spinach? Are you going to use chard? Are you going to use kale? Like, what are you going to substitute? And how is that going to change the food, you know, and make it sort of like, again, more of like a borderlands food, a food that reflects where we are now. Another thing I just kind of briefly wanted to return to, you talked about the contradictions in the modern day. You know, traditional Mesoamerican food relied 100% on the labor of Mexican women grinding corn all day long to make masa. And, you know, in contemporary society where women are required to work for profit, for work outside the home, you know, we don't really want to say women should go back to grinding corn all day long, but sort of think about what resources are available to make good organic you know, stone ground, hand ground corn available. Moose has this fantasy that they really want there to be local collectives of organic masa, corn masa, so that people can make fresh corn tortillas and tlacoyos or whatever it is with fresh organic corn masa available all the time, and that, you know, small collectives could make that available.
And of course, the fruits and vegetables that we do obtain today are often not very reminiscent of their original forms. Even organic foods have been bred to be maximized for sweetness, maximized for, you know, shelf life, etc. The original forms of lots of fruits and vegetables and even grains like corn were quite different. And Vandana Shiva talks a little bit about this. Is there a move to find old seed banks to try to bring back some of these older varieties that may not be the most pleasing to the palate in terms of maximum sweetness, but may have a variety of other nutrition and, you know, can be tasty?
There is. I think that all over the country, there's a real emphasis on heritage crops, heirloom crops, and you know, some of the Native American communities have been gifted with historical, you know, I can't remember the organization right now, but an elderly woman had been conserving these seeds, these indigenous seeds, for generations, and then she gave them to an indigenous community garden so that they could then produce them, keep them alive, continue to grow them and reintroduce them into the foodways. And that is just a really amazing aspect of this. And again, like in the really commercial sense, you know, the fancy health food stores sell the heirloom tomatoes that are like ugly and weird shaped in different colors and have much, much more flavor than the traditional varieties that we're used to seeing, like the beefsteak tomato or whatever. And so that the tastes are really dramatically different. Foods like the tomato actually were really sour for the Spaniards, and they viewed it with a lot of distrust. And it wasn't until they started making the tomato more and more sweet that it became, you know, more attractive to Europeans. And so for that reason, I mean, we really enjoy using the tomatillo, the wild Mexican tomato. It's not the same as the red tomato. It's different. It's sometimes closer to a ground cherry, but it's so much more tangy and sour. And so we think that that's probably closer to what tomatoes were when they were first introduced, were like.
So can you go through some of the recipes in your book? What are some of your favorites? I mean, I noticed that you also have very basic cooking techniques, such as how to cook a pot of beans, you know, for those among us who just don't are intimidated by cooking and don't have much experience cooking. But then there's also some very, you know, some recipes with some very complex set of ingredients for the more daring cooks. Can you sort of throw out some of these you know, recipes and their titles that you think might excite our listeners?
Some of the real basic ones again are like the soldadera beans, things that involve using a crock pot so that you can, you know, you can cook your food during the day and develop those flavors and develop those.
Soldaderas being the term for Mexican female soldiers, right?
Right. Mexican women during the Mexican Revolution who took up arms. And so we really just, you know, like we're like, you're fighting all day, you know, what do you eat that night? And so that was like one idea, but some of them, you know, Luz is really the chef in the family, and I'm really sort of like the cleanup crew, but there's times when I have to do the cooking. And so a lot of the recipes are about like Luz teaching me how to cook certain meals, you know, like bake this for this amount of time, take it out, make this sauce. And then when I get home, it'll be all ready to put together.
And any other sort of, you even have like a dessert section, which is pretty cool.
Right. There's a chocolate amaranth cake that Luz makes that is just amazing. And the amaranth, again, is a native seed-like grain. And because the amaranth is part of the dessert, it gives it a kind of balance, a kind of weight to it, so that you're not just eating a lot of sugars that will really throw your blood sugar out of control, but it's balanced by the protein and the complex carbohydrates in the dessert. So it's not the same as eating like a slice of chocolate cake. It doesn't make you, it doesn't throw your body out of whack in the same way.
And so finally, I'm wondering if you can also comment on the fact that other, you know, people with other indigenous roots, say non-Mexican Mexican indigenous roots, can also, in a way, try to reclaim their food preparation, right? I mean, I'm from India, and it's not clear to me how much of our cuisine was altered by British colonialism.
Right.
But home-cooked Indian food is very different from restaurant foods. The same might be said for many indigenous cultures from all over the world, right?
Right, exactly. And I think that because our traditional foods have a lot of health benefits that are not recognized and they're not mainstream. So again, like eating things like wild greens will give you something that eating spinach won't necessarily give you, right? It may have a different taste profile. It may be tangy. It may be crunchy. It may be, you know, it may have a different texture. And because foods have been mainstream so much to be appealing to a wide audience, we lose that richness and diversity of the diet. And so I think that actually most communities should think about like what was indigenous to our diet. Foods like the Filipino people have a really immense biodiversity of fruits and vegetables. But they too are subjected to a lot of the diseases of development of Mexican Americans. And so what does it mean to look at traditional Filipino foods and bring them, you know, emphasize what's healthful and use it to nurture our health, our community's health?
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website you can share about your book?
Yes, our website is www.decolonizeyourdiet.net. And of course, you can also reach us through our Facebook page, Decolonize Your Diet. We post current recipes and, you know, relevant articles about people of color communities and reclaiming ancestral foods.
And we'll post a link to UprisingWithSonali.com later today. Catriona, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali. It was great talking with you.
Catriona Rueda Esquivel is an associate professor in race and resistance studies at San Francisco State University. She is the author, with Luz Calvo, of the book Decolonize Your Diet, Food Justice in Communities of Color. This is Uprising, back in just a moment.